Well, it's very nice to be back in Durham and to have the opportunity to speak to you all again. I'm going to tell you about some work that I did recently in collaboration with my student, Owen Madden, and also with Jose Figueroa Farrell in Edinburgh, and Joan Simon, who's just recently moved to Pennsylvania. The motivation for this work is, of course, in a general sense, just the ADS-CFT correspondence. It would be interesting to look at what locally ADS spaces we can form by making quotients along the orbits of some appropriate Killing vector and see what the interpretation of those is in terms of the dual field theory. And also, from an even more general perspective, one's interested in finding non-trivial exact backgrounds for string theory with less symmetry. And ADS space provides a very nice maximally symmetric background. By taking quotients, we can break some of that symmetry and see if we can get, for example, interesting time-dependent backgrounds. And one of the lessons of this is that we find that these quotients are, in fact, less time-dependent than the quotients of flat space, which were studied a couple of years ago. The work was described in these three papers. The first paper is written by Owen Madden, myself, and describes just the basics of classification of quotients for anti-de Sitter space in arbitrary dimensions. The second paper, which was produced in parallel, was done by Jose and Joan, and they did a much more thorough analysis, a much longer paper, discussing the quotients of ADS P plus 1 cross SQ and the supersymmetries that are preserved under the quotients, which is a highly non-trivial issue that I'm not going to have the time to say anything about today. Then the third paper, which was written by this full collaboration, discussed the physics and the geometrical properties of a couple of the interesting quotients that we identified in the classification. And that's probably mostly what I'm going to talk about today. I should also say, this is the first time I'm doing a talk using the laptop. So we'll see how it goes. This is a new LaTeX document class I just discovered called Beamer.
It's very attractive.
And if you like it, I can tell you, just go to Google and type Beamer LaTeX, and you will be taken to its homepage.
EA.
Beamer. This is a Beamer. Okay, so I'm going to start out by talking about the classification of quotients. What we're interested in is discrete cyclic quotients of ADS P plus 1 cross SQ. So we want to take the quotients along the orbits of some Killing vector. And the key result here is that the Killing vectors in anti-de Sitter space can be decomposed in terms of a rather short list of elementary building blocks. And I'll explain how we build up the normal form for the general ADS Killing vector. The other key result is that the resulting quotient spacetime will contain closed time-like curves if that Killing vector on the anti-de Sitter factor is time-like anywhere in the anti-de Sitter space. In particular, this means that even if I add an ADS and a sphere Killing vector in such a way that I get a Killing vector which is space-like everywhere, if the ADS Killing vector is time-like, I still get closed time-like curves.
You explain why that's true.
Yeah, I'm going to give a proof of that statement. So that's just what I'm going to have to say about the classification. Then I'm going to try to spend most of the time talking about the quotients which don't have closed time-like curves, and that's what we focused on in the third paper. And to get a better understanding of what these quotients are like, we did three things in each case. We look at the symmetries that are preserved by the quotient, so what Killing vectors commute with the one that we're quotienting along. And we try to build a global coordinate system which is adapted to those symmetries as much as possible to make the structure of the quotient explicit. And that's just basically building new coordinate systems on anti-de Sitter space. And then, because, of course, we're interested in the relation to a dual field theory, we examined the action of the quotient on the conformal boundary as well. So there are two cases where the ADS Killing vector is everywhere space-like, which are called the self-dual orbifold and the double null rotation. This case was actually already discussed in ADS-3 in some detail. And so I'll spend some time talking about those. And then there's some cases where the Killing vector is everywhere non-time-like, but not everywhere space-like. And those are a little more difficult, so I'll talk about them briefly. The other thing that I'll talk about is black holes. And of course, the most familiar example of a locally anti-de Sitter space is the BTC black hole. and one can ask, what kind of black hole-like quotients can I construct in higher dimensions? This is a question that had been studied previously. We haven't got much to add to it. The basic result is simply that the only quotients in higher dimensions that you can give the natural black hole interpretation to are those which are the quotients by the Killing vector, which in ADS3 would give me the non-rotating VTZ black holes. And I'll explain why that's true. So to start off with, our aim is to describe, as I said, these discrete cyclic quotients by some group gamma with one generator. Such gamma are generated by some Killing vector in the isometry algebra, and I break my Killing vector up into an ADS component and a sphere component, living in SO2P and SOQ plus 1, respectively. It's familiar that for the sphere, I can write the most general Killing vector in a normal form in terms of a collection of rotations in orthogonal two planes. So what I want to do in this first part is explain the similar normal form, construction of a similar normal form for the ADS Killing vector. So we can bring the Killing vector to normal form by conjugation because the quotient by conjugate subgroups will be isometric. And in the normal form, we decompose the Killing vector into a collection of elementary blocks, each of which acts on some orthogonal subspace in the full R2P embedding space for ADSP plus 1. To give you some context, I'll remind you that in flat space, this question of quotients was studied in a relatively recent paper by Figaro, Farrell, and Simon. And in R1P, the elementary blocks were translations, which act on a one-dimensional subspace, rotations and boosts, which act on two-dimensional subspaces, which are either plus plus or plus minus signature. I'm happy to know that. If that's the only glitch I have, I'll be just as glad. And a third kind called null rotations, which I'll remind you of the form of in a minute, which act on a three-dimensional subspace of signature plus plus minus. So now we want to see what the equivalent list is in ADS. And the point is, for the sphere, the list was just rotations. For flat space, the list had these four elements. And for ADS, it's going to be slightly longer. So we want to work in embedding coordinates. This is always the most convenient thing to do if you want to talk about the isometries of ADS, because in the embedding coordinates, the Killing vectors act linearly. So the first two coordinates, x1 and x2, will be time-like, and the remainder will be space-like. From here on in, I'm going to set the radius of my anti-de Sitter space to 1 for simplicity, and I'm going to introduce this notation eij to denote the usual basis of Killing vectors. Okay, so here's the big result from the first two papers, and this took a lot longer to get than it takes to describe. Well, not that much longer, a couple of weeks of calculations. Here are all the possible elementary blocks, indecomposable Killing vectors acting on spaces of the form RMN, where M is less than 2, and N, this is the signature in the superscript. So we have our rotations. This is a rotation in the 3-4 plane embedding coordinates. This is a boost between the 1 and 3 coordinates. Because we have two time-like directions, I can also have a rotation which acts in those two time-like directions. From the point of view of a global coordinate system on ADS, that's just the global time translation isometry. Then I have a null rotation, which acts on this plus plus minus subspace, which has a boost mixed with the space-like rotation. I also have this null rotation in minus minus plus, which mixes the time-like rotation with a boost. That's something possibly I didn't have in the flat space case. And then I have these additional possibilities. I have four-dimensional elementary blocks, which are basically mixtures of one null rotation and another null rotation with possibly some additional boost components or additional rotation components. I should note that any parameter I write is assumed to be non-zero. So that's why there's this and this are treated as independent cases. Then there's one five-dimensional block and one six-dimensional block. And the interesting observation is that there's nothing higher. I can't write any indecomposable action on ADS greater than 5, which doesn't break up into a combination of these things.
I'm sure these are very silly questions, but what is a block? What does it mean to be a block?
Well, what I mean here is simply that I'm writing some killing vector, which is acting on a subspace of R2P. And my general killing vector is going to be built of blocks. So a block is just a component that I can add together with arbitrary coefficients to build the normal form for the general killing vector.
But, you know, I mean, for example, your B22 plus minus about the middle of the page.
Okay.
As on the right, four different things added or subtracted. Why couldn't I just take those four things separately?
Okay. So, why don't I say, for example, to take a simpler example, that B12 is a boost plus a rotation?
Right.
Because these don't act on orthogonal subspaces.
Okay. So
you see, this is a boost in the 1-3 direction, and this is a rotation in the 3-4 directions.
Okay.
So when I write a normal form, I'm going to write something like B12. So the idea is that when I write a normal form, I want to write in terms of a collection of blocks which commute with each other, and so that act on orthogonal subspaces. Keep thinking of the example of a sphere, where I write the killing vector in normal form as a collection of rotations in orthogonal subspaces. So I want to break my R2P up into orthogonal subspaces, and on each of those orthogonal subspaces, one of these things is acting. No, I mean something much simpler. For example, if I wanted to write a normal form for a translational killing vector, I would write A partial X plus B partial Y plus C partial Z. And X, Y, and Z are orthogonal subspaces.
That's an inferior number. What is it for
O3? For SO3, it's... if I write it as a sphere in three dimensions, it's a rotation in the 1-2 plane. And every killing vector is conjugate to a rotation in the 1-2 plane in SO3.
So for the hyperbolic plane, there's hyperbolic, parabolic, and whatever they are. And I see three up there that only involve the elements 1, 2, and 3. So presumably those are the familiar three kinds of translation.
Yeah.
I had no idea that there was such a
rule of them. The point is that as you go to more and more time-like directions, the structure gets richer and richer. Mm-hmm. In SOQ plus 1, in the compact group, which is embeddable in a Euclidean space, there's only one kind of elementary block, which is rotations. In R1P, if we ignore the translations, which is really in the Poincaré symmetry, there's three kinds, and they can act on two-dimensional or three-dimensional subspaces. In R2P, there's a whole bunch of kinds, and they can act on subspaces which have up to six components.
So in some sense, the fact that the most complicated thing here is a 2 and a 4 is just because if it was one time-like direction, the most complicated thing would have a 1 and a 2, and this is twice as many time directions or something?
There's certainly that pattern, but I don't have a general understanding of the pattern. Okay, so now I want to take these things and add them together to build the normal form for my most general killing vector. Because I'm acting on a space with two time-like directions, I can have at most two of these. I can only have one of any of those, and I could have two of these things which involve one time-like direction. And I can have as many rotations as I can fit in. Now, there were only 8 or so possibilities on the last slide, but when I start adding them together, that gives me a rather long list of possibilities for the normal forms of killing vectors. There's actually quite a rich structure of inequivalent symmetries that I can quotient along in ADSP in reasonably high dimension. So we break these up into groups by norm. We look, take the norm of the Killing vector on ADS, and we say, is it always space-like, or does it become null or time-like somewhere? And because that's what I'm going to focus on later, I'm here just going to tell you what the possibilities are if I insist that the norm is everywhere non-negative. So the simplest thing is just some combination of rotations. And this is the quotient of ADS, which has been the most studied in the past. Another possibility, which is everywhere non-negative, is to take a null rotation and a collection of rotations, or to take one of these four-dimensional blocks with a collection of rotations. These two cases are non-negative, but the norm does vanish somewhere. So I'm going to talk about those last. Then there are two cases where it's everywhere space-like. One is a combination of boosts with the parameter in the two boosts equal up to sign. And the other is a combination of two null rotations. This is what we call the self-dual overfold, and this is called the double null rotation for obvious reasons. Gary?
You have parameters for the rotations, sort of how far you rotate.
Yeah.
But no parameters for the null boosts. But why isn't there a parameter associated for how far you...
Yeah, I think it's something like that. I think basically the point is, in this case, for example, I can define what this parameter means in a coordinate invariant way by saying that's the norm of the Killing vector. And by conjugation, I can't change the norm of the Killing vector. But this thing is actually null. And so I don't have a coordinate invariant characterization of what it would mean to put a number in front. And I think Don's right. I can, by conjugation, I can remove any non-zero coefficient. Oh, one other thing I forgot to say. The plus and minus here correspond to Killing vectors that differ by an orientation reversal. And those are the same symmetry as far as the metric is concerned, but differ in their action on the phi form. And in particular, will have different consequences for supersymmetry, although I'm not going to talk about that today. Okay, so this is basically a special case of the Killing vector you would use to generate the BTZ black holes. And this, it so happens that this special case, where beta 1 equals beta 2, doesn't give me a black hole. It gives me a constantly regular quotient. This is something that had been noticed before, but it remained obscure in the literature. To give you an example of a Killing vector which has negative norm, because it's useful to have something concrete to think about in the next part of the argument, if I take global time translation and I combine that with some rotations, then that will always have clearly that will always be a time-like direction near the axis of ADS, but I can add enough of these things in even P so that anywhere at large distances, I'm going along a space-like direction. So I can generate a Killing vector in this way whose norm is bounded below. Now, if I also remember that I have a three-sphere in the game, I could define my quotient so that I'm also quotienting with a twist on the three-sphere. So I identify points like this, say, in such a way that the overall Killing vector is everywhere space-like. Nonetheless, this quotient is going to have closed time-like curves. And the point is that although these two points may be space-like separated because they're so far apart on the sphere, eventually, as I make identifications far enough up here, the time-like separation on this part grows and grows and grows, but the space-like separation on this part can never be bigger than the size of the sphere. So eventually, these two points that I'm identifying are going to be time-like separated in the full space-time, and I'm going to get closed time-like curves. And in fact, I can argue, using basically that logic, that in any quotient where the ADS killing vector is time-like somewhere, I'm going to get close time-like curves. And the point is simply I consider a point where this killing vector is time-like. I link it to some image of that point by following the integral curve of the killing vector and the ADS factor, along which this integral curve has a time-like tangent everywhere, because the norm of the killing vector is constant along its integral curve. And instead of following the integral curve of whatever killing vector I'm using on the sphere, I just follow some length-minimizing geodesic. And then the tangent to the curve that I generate in this way will have a norm which is the norm of the ADS killing vector plus I'm going along on the sphere. I can go at most a distance L, which is the diameter of the sphere, and I'm going that distance as I go a distance NL in the affine parameter of the orbit. So for N large enough, this sphere factor doesn't matter, and the norm of the tangent to this curve is negative. That is, the curve's time-like, and when I make the identifications, it's going to become a closed time-like curve. So if I'm interested in causally regular quotients, the only killing vectors I need to consider are these five here. And that's what I'm going to focus on for most of the talk. When I get to the end, I'll talk about black holes, which is quotients where there's closed time-like curves in some part of the space-time, and we just throw that part of the space-time away. But for now, let's try to construct complete space-times, which have no closed time-like curves. The first case has been extensively studied in the past, so I won't say anything further about that. And I'll focus first on the two cases where the killing vector is everywhere space-like. So we saw in this table that you have some non-trivial part, and then you have a whole bunch of rotations. So we're going to focus on the lowest dimensional ADS space in which each case can arise, because the adding in the rotations in higher dimensions doesn't change the structure in any essential way. And in fact, one can describe the action on the ADS P plus 1 space in terms of the action on the lowest dimensional ADS space where that non-trivial block part can act, by writing the ADS space in a suitable coordinate system, and the rotations will act here, and it's just some twisting of whatever action you had on the original space. This implies that there will be a nice representation of the conformal boundary for such quotients, where I write the boundary in a coordinate system where it looks like an ADS space across a sphere. Similarly, if I add in some non-trivial action on the sphere, which I'm going to ignore for most of the discussion, I can construct an adapted coordinate system on the sphere, and then an overall adapted coordinate system is just some linear transformation from suitable adapted coordinates just on the ADS factor. Okay, so let's talk first about this killing vector, which is a combination of a pair of boosts, which I think these people invented this name, self-dual orbifold, for this. This was originally studied by Cousser and Hanau, who identified this as an interesting special case of the V to Z quotient ADS3. And Vijay Balasubramanian, Asad Naqvi, and Joan Simon wrote a paper recently where they explored in detail the connection between this quotient and a dual field theory. So we'll apply the general procedure that I advocated. First, we want to see what symmetries are preserved under this quotient. So we're acting with the killing vector, which in the simplest ADS3 context is just a combination of two boosts. And that will always lie in one SL2R factor when I decompose SO22 into a pair of SL2Rs. So the other SL2R factor commutes with this killing vector, and the quotient has an R cross SL2R symmetry. One of the killing vectors in this SL2R symmetry is everywhere time-like. I can only adapt my coordinates to one of the killing vectors, so I'll choose to adapt it to the time-like one. And that gives me a coordinate system on the quotient, which looks like this. I have, this is my time-like direction associated with this killing vector. Phi is the coordinate associated with the quotient, so the quotient in this coordinate system is just periodic identification of this phi coordinate. And then there's a radial coordinate z. So I go out to large z, this off-diagonal term becomes the dominant component of the metric. This metric writes ADS3 as an S1 fibration over ADS2. This may look familiar, at least to Don. And an interesting thing to note about this, which we pointed out in our paper, which didn't appear to have been previously realized, is that t is a global time function for this metric. So it's a time coordinate which is increasing along every future-directed causal curve. That implies that there can be no closed time-like curves in this space-time, which is important. I gave you an argument previously that there will be closed time-like curves if Xi ADS is time-like, but that certainly doesn't imply that there won't be closed time-like curves if Xi ADS is space-like. I still need to show that in each example. So this shows that this thing is free of closed time-like curves. In fact, it shows a stronger statement. It shows that it's stably causal. It will remain free of closed time-like curves even if I change the light cones a little bit, which is a nice property for a space-time to have.
Simon, did you say that this was actually a special case in the BTC black hole?
It's not a special case in the BTC black hole. It's a special case of the quotient, which for more general values of the parameters would give you the BTC black hole. So if beta 1 and beta 2 were not equal, this would be a rotating black hole. Now, beta 1 equals beta 2 would be the same in terms of the usual black hole parameters as r plus equals r minus. But as you know, the quotient that gives you an extreme black hole is in a different class from the quotient that gives you the non-extreme black hole. So this is the extreme limit of the quotient that gives you non-extreme black holes. And it gives you a completely different solution. It doesn't have any closed time-like curves anymore.
Is this the reason why you can factorify an extreme black string in an extreme black hole? If you factorify an ADS3 geometry in the net horizon region of black string, you get an ADS2 geometry in the net horizon region of black hole. The circle here is the
possibly. I don't know if... I assume it must be the same compactification. So what does the conformal boundary of this space look like? It has two disconnected components because my coordinate z here can go off to plus or minus infinity. The metric on the conformal boundary is just given by the last term in the previous metric, the off-diagonal term, because when I rescale by the usual e to the 2z conformal factor, the other terms will disappear in the limit. This implies that whereas my identification direction was space-like in the bulk, it's null in the boundary, and the quotient has closed causal curves in its boundary. Vijay and collaborators argued that there might be some relation to DLCQ in the dual field theory here. The boundaries are, of course, connected through the bulk, so if I consider the usual bulk boundary calculation of correlation functions, there will be non-trivial correlations between the two boundaries, which must translate into some suitable entangled state of a CFT living on the two boundary theories. The one point that we made here was that in higher dimensions, the situation is slightly different because the boundary will be connected and causally well-behaved for most of the boundary because we saw that the boundary metric will contain a factor of the bulk metric. The point is that this... an eraser? Oh, there we are. This foliation of a higher dimensional ADS space in terms of lower dimensional ADS space looks in a cartoon form. Something like that. The leaves go through the bulk, and this is the chi direction. So I go to, there's a copy of the bulk of the lower dimensional ADS factor in the boundary of the higher dimensional ADS factor. So the quotient in higher dimensions, the boundary will just look like this plus a suitable sphere factor. And the quotient in higher dimensions is along a direction which is space-like most places in the boundary. I can still reach the boundary by going to z goes to plus or minus infinity, so there's still points on the boundary where the quotient is generating closed causal curves. But the boundary metric is not going to be of the somewhat degenerate form in higher dimensional examples. Okay, so let me come on now and talk about the double null rotation, which is the thing that I think is really interesting. This is a quotient by a pair of null rotations. We're going to consider the ADS-5 case because that's the first ADS space in which this quotient can act. In Poincaré coordinates, this acts as a null brain on the surfaces of constant z, the flat slices. It has a surprisingly rich structure of symmetries. In addition to the Killing vector I'm quotienting along, there are four commuting Killing vectors which have these interesting non-trivial commutation relations. This shows us that the first three Killing vectors form a Heisenberg algebra on which the fourth Killing vector is acting as an outer automorphism. If I'd said those words to you 3 years ago, everybody would have looked blank, but that's a familiar sounding story now. The quotient symmetry is the semi-direct product of the Heisenberg with a real plus a real for psi. The norms of these Killing vectors, these two guys are space-like. Their norms are actually equal to that of the vector that I'm quotienting along. This one is null. That's also familiar. And this extra guy here is time-like. So again, as in the self-dual orbifold case, I have an everywhere time-like symmetry. So let me construct adaptive coordinates for...
Did you just say that this could be viewed... You take ordinary ADS in Poincaré slices and just do a null brain on each of those Poincaré slices?
Yeah.
And that's what you get?
That's the quotient I'm taking. And for that quotient, there are quite a few Killing vectors which commute with the quotient. And in fact, these three, Xi1, Xi2, and Xi3, are also symmetries of the null brain. These also act in the flat slices. They're independent of the z direction in the Poincaré coordinates. Xi4 involves the z direction, so it doesn't appear as a symmetry of the null brain.
And that's the one that's time-like.
That's the one that's time-like. This null one, of course, is a familiar symmetry in the null brain. As far as I can tell, nobody realized there were these other two space-like symmetries in the null brain previously. I'll have a little more to say about the relation of the null brain in a minute. Let me first analyze this just following my nose in the same way that we did the self-dual orbifold. Because I'm fascinated by causal structure, I'm going to choose my coordinate systems that are adapted to the time-like and the null symmetry, as well as the quotient. And that allows me to write the metric in this surprisingly simple form. This has nothing to do, on the face of it, with the description in terms of the null brain and Poincaré coordinates, which is somewhat messier. Phi is the direction that I'm quotienting along. So when I make the quotient, this phi will be periodically identified. T is the time-like symmetry, and V is the null symmetry. And psi looks like it's trying to be a symmetry, but it didn't quite make it. Okay, so we saw that there's a Heisenberg algebra and there's a null Killing vector. So there ought to be some relation to the plane wave hiding in here somewhere. And in fact, if I make a coordinate transformation, I define a new coordinate z, which is e to the minus rho, I can make this thing look much more like a plane wave than it currently does. I bring this null factor out front, as I conventionally do for plane waves. Taking 1 over z squared outside, this norm 1 time-like component becomes norm z squared. And then I've got a transverse space. And then I've got some weird off-diagonal cross term. But in fact, this conformal metric is a plane wave. And if I make a coordinate transformation, which is a time-dependent rotation in the transverse psi phi space, plus some redefinition of the v-coordinate, then I can make that quite obvious. That now looks really familiar. Now, of course, I haven't told you anything that should surprise you. We know that such a plane wave, this symmetric plane wave, is conformally flat, as is anti-de Sitter space. So it should be a relatively trivial exercise to find a coordinate system in which an anti-de Sitter space is conformal to that plane wave. What's surprising is that the coordinate transformation is relatively simple, because I always somehow pictured this quite differently. The anti-de Sitter space fits into the cylinder, it fits into the Einstein static universe as half of it, whereas the plane wave is leaving out some curve that's spiraling around. But it looks like it's much simpler than that. So the anti-de Sitter space is being mapped to half the plane wave. This coordinate z is positive, and z equals 0 is the conformal boundary. What's more interesting is that this is a very nice coordinate system, or at least this is a very nice coordinate system for describing this non-trivial quotient, because the symmetries xi, xi3, and xi4 commute with this conformal factor. They're just partial phi, partial v, and partial t. And in fact, so do the other two symmetries. So the quotient, when I make this phi periodic, is conformally equivalent to the quotient of this plane wave where I make this phi periodic, which in terms of this coordinate system is a quotient along the killing vector called E1 and the killing plus E2 star. It's one of the quotients that Jeremy Michelson considered in the discussion of quotients of the plane wave. Okay, so I've only told you what z is.
So how is the conformal factor in terms of the 1 over z squared in front is a function of the other ones? Is it the same as the?
Well, this is what z is in this coordinate system. If you want to know what it is in embedding coordinates, I haven't told you that, of course, but I can tell you. Do you want to know what z is in the embedding coordinates?
In the plane wave coordinates, after the negative coordinates. It's just one of the coordinates?
This is the plane wave, and this is z. Z is one of the coordinates in the transverse space. So the idea is that I have here, because I'm talking about ADS5, I have a five-dimensional plane wave with three-dimensional transverse space, and one of those three directions is distinguished. ADS space is conformal to half of the plane wave. The space is z greater than 0, where z is one of the space-like transverse components in your bog-standard usual coordinate system on the plane wave. And this is probably worth remembering, quite apart from what I want to do with it in my talk. This is an interesting new coordinate system, a new way to think about anti-de Sitter spaces.
So, what does that tell us about the conformal boundary of the plane wave?
Of the plane wave, I don't think it tells us much. Okay. I'm going to use it to tell us something about the conformal boundary of anti-de Sitter space, or of this quotient.
But if they're conformal to each other, they don't have the same conformal boundary.
No, certainly not. Because the points at z equals 0, which would be interpreted as ordinary points to the interior of this plane wave spacetime, are going to be interpreted as points of the conformal boundary of the of anti-de Sitter space, or of the quotient, because that's where this conformal factor blows up.
Well, so but they're related. You just have to add
yeah, points. They're related. Yeah, the conformal compactification of any one of these spaces is the Einstein static universe. Or half the Einstein static universe in the case of anti-de Sitter space.
I'm just going to comment the subtle point here, of course, is that your conformal map from one to the other is not a one-to-one onto map. It maps, as you said, the half of the plane wave.
Sure.
So the boundaries are tricky because you only have parts of the space to work
with. Anyways, so I'm going to do two things with this. First of all, the connection to plane waves makes it easy to find a time function for this description of anti-de Sitter space, for this quotient, showing once again that the resulting quotient space is going to be stably causal and, as in particular, doesn't have any closed time-like curves, which is something we wanted to know. It's also a nice description from the point of view of finding the conformal boundary. The conformal boundary at z equals 0 in my previous metric has just the metric in brackets with z set to 0, which looks like this. This is, again, a plane wave, and if I make phi periodic, it's some compactified plane wave. I haven't thought about the dual field theory here, but this ought to be easier than the case of the self-dual Urbe fold, because there are no closed time-like curves in the boundary. This is one of the quotients of the plane waves which was shown not to introduce closed time-like curves, and this metric is also stably causal. Now, this might, you might now be a little confused, because I told you that this quotient of anti-de Sitter space acted as the null brain in the Poincaré slices. So you expect to see a null brain in the conformal boundary. You expect to see that in the Poincaré coordinates, the conformal boundary would just have been the null brain. So what is the relation between this object and the null brain? Well, I can apply the same logic to the null brain that I've been applying all along. It's a quotient along a translation plus a null rotation. It has three commuting symmetries. There's an obvious null symmetry, which is just d1 plus d3. And there's two commuting space-like symmetries. Note that there's no time-like symmetry in this case, which is what we expected. And I can do adapted coordinates again. Because I've only got three symmetries, I could adapt to Xi3 and one of Xi1 and Xi2, but that turns out not to give me a global coordinate system. However, it does inspire me to find a nice global coordinate system, which is this metric. So this is a new description of the null brain, which looks very like what I had before. And indeed, if I set u to be tan t, this is now up to a conformal factor the same as this metric I found on the conformal boundary of the double null rotation. So that shows me that the two metrics are conformally equivalent. I was getting the compactified plane wave on the boundary of the double null rotation because I worked with a particular conformal factor as I took the limit going to the boundary. But I could equally well have got the null brain that I expected to get by using a slightly different conformal factor.
And is u equals 0 and v in the boundary of the Poincaré, is the boundary of the Poincaré patch on the boundary?
Yes. Yeah, where this blows up is on the boundary of the Poincaré patch on the boundary.
Excellent.
The other thing I wanted to say here before I go back is that this, again, relating the null brain to a plane wave allows me to easily identify a time function for the null brain. And this is, again, this is some nice new coordinate system that you might want to use in thinking about the null brain, because we've all got quite used to thinking about plane waves, and so it's useful to relate other spacetimes that you're interested in to the plane waves. This description of the conformal boundary is to be preferred to the null brain description for two reasons. First of all, it covers more of the boundary. The null brain only covers one Poincaré patch. And second of all, it makes more of the symmetry evident. In this coordinate system, all the isometries of the bulk double null rotation spacetime that are preserved by the quotient act as isometries in the conformal boundary and not as conformal isometries. And in particular, the time-like symmetry in the bulk is still acting as an isometry. It's null in the boundary. It's this translation in T. So this ought to be an easy case to understand the relation between the bulk and the field theory, because all of the quotient that I'm taking acts as just as a quotient in the field theory. If I write the field theory in an appropriate coordinate system, and this is basically, this is a coordinate system on the Einstein static universe that covers almost all of the Einstein static universe. The points that are missed out correspond to the fixed points in the boundary of the Killing vector that I intend to quotient along. Okay, so that covers the space-like cases. I should now go on to briefly discuss these cases that are not everywhere space-like. The first example of these is something you thought maybe I should have talked about before, which is the simplest kind of quotient I can consider that looks like it's going to be causally regular. I can write the metric in Poincaré coordinates and say, let's just periodically identify x. That corresponds, in the language that I introduced earlier, to a null rotation in the embedding space. The only commuting symmetry is partial t. This case looks like the simplest thing to study, but it's actually one of the most complicated. There are several non-trivial issues that need to be dealt with here. First of all, that, of course, isn't a global coordinate system, and this isn't a globally regular quotient. There are both fixed points and causal curves in the horizon at z equals 0 if I just apply this quotient. One would need to add some sphere deformation, like I talked about for the quotient by a global time translation, to get a causally regular space-time. So I really need to work in six dimensions with the sphere. And even then, I'm not going to have any global adapted coordinate system, because I can't construct a good coordinate system for the ADS action around the fixed points. And the action on the conformal boundary is also complicated. There are isolated fixed points in the conformal boundary. Basically, in the Poincaré coordinates, they correspond to the points at past and future time-like infinity and at space-like infinity. Those are all fixed points of an ordinary spatial translation. And because I leave out the fixed points when I consider the action of the quotient on the boundary, the resulting quotient at the boundary is not going to be simply connected. I'm going to have holes in it that I can go around in different ways. So that's going to be quite a complicated case to consider. And we haven't dealt with it any further than that. The other case that we did deal with in a little more detail was this quotient by this four-dimensional block. This is a killing vector whose norm is everywhere 0. And it corresponds to the quotient along the null directions in Poincaré coordinates. This turns out to be nicer than the quotient just along a space-like direction, perhaps surprisingly. First of all, it preserves more symmetry, because this killing vector, being chiral, lies in one of the two SL2R factors. And so the quotient has an R across SL2R symmetry, and it, in particular, it has a killing vector which is everywhere time-like, which is preserved by the quotient. Unlike the previous case, which had a time-like killing vector partial t, but it's not everywhere time-like. Also, I can build a nice global coordinate system for this. There are no fixed points in the bulk. There are closed causal curves all over the place, but at least there are no fixed points, so I can describe it globally. So the metric looks like this. This is sort of a simplified or toy version of the kind of thing that I had showing up in my double null rotation. I have a flat metric plus e to the 2 rho times some cross term. V is now the coordinate associated with my quotient, so I'm going to make V periodic, which is certainly going to result in closed causal curves. But I can fix that by adding some non-vanishing killing vector on the 3-sphere. If I pick this to be some vector field which doesn't vanish anywhere on the sphere, then the resulting quotient will be everywhere space-like. And I can write a six-dimensional metric which makes this obvious. There are now non-zero dv squared terms, so periodic identifications in V don't obviously introduce any closed time-like curves. Unfortunately, unlike the previous cases, when there's no time function for this space-time, it's a little bit causally intermediate.
You know there's no time function, or just haven't found one?
I know that there is no time function which is inherited from the parent ADS space. There's no time function on ADS which is invariant under this quotient. The argument is simple. If instead of considering the discrete quotient, I took this space and Kaluza-Klein reduced along the V direction, then this coordinate psi prime, which started out life as one of the coordinates on the sphere, is going to be null in the reduced metric. So the reduced metric, that coordinate's periodically identified because it's an angular coordinate on the sphere, so the reduced metric is going to have closed null curves. And so therefore, it certainly can't have a time function. But any time function on ADS space, which was invariant under the quotient, would descend to a time function on the Kaluza-Klein reduction. So there can't be any such time function. It's, I think, theoretically possible this has a time function which doesn't lift to a function on ADS, but I wouldn't know how to go about finding it.
Okay.
again, I can construct the conformal boundary. This is, again, very similar to the double null rotation case. I define a radial coordinate, which is e to the minus rho, and my metric, where I'm now packaging this twisted object back up, calling it a three-sphere, now looks like a symmetric plane wave written in angular in polar coordinates. The boundary in this case is in this case, the bulk metric doesn't cover half the plane wave; it covers all of the plane wave except for the axis. And the boundary at r equals 0 is a two-dimensional space, as you would expect, because I only have an ADS3 factor in here. And it again has a periodically identified null direction. So the boundary has closed causal curves. In fact, the boundary here looks the same as one of the two boundaries in the self-dual case. I don't see any further relation between the two cases, but that's perhaps an interesting thing to explore further. Okay, so I think that's... That's everything I have to say about the causally regular quotients. Are there any questions about that part? Okay, well, let me just whip on through the black hole section. So what is a black hole? A black hole is where I take part of the ADS space and I throw it away. If I can get a causally regular quotient by throwing away part of the ADS space and the boundary of the part that I threw away is hidden by an event horizon, then I interpret the resulting quotient as a black hole. So the original ADS3 analysis was done by Beniados, Teitelbaum, and Zanelli, and I'm going to skip most of this review, just point out that the region that we removed, which was at r squared less than 0, was simply the region where the killing vector is time-like. The extension of this to higher dimensions has previously been studied by Beniados and collaborators and by Holst and Peldan. And what Holst and Peldan did was basically to do the classification of quotients of ADS4, so a special case of what I've just been describing, but from the point of view of identifying candidate black hole solutions. So the first question we have to ask ourselves is, what region do we want to remove? Removing the region that we removed before will not eliminate all the CTCs. The curves that follow the orbit of just the non-trivial part and some minimum length path on the sphere factor in ADS will lead to time-like curves by the same argument that I gave earlier on about combinations of ADS and sphere-killing vectors in the direct product. So the region we want to remove more than just the region where the full ADS killing vector is time-like. If the killing vector has some rotational components, we remove the region where the killing vector is time-like. We just drop those rotational components, where just the non-trivial part of the killing vector is time-like. It turns out that because this relates the classification of quotients in the higher dimensional space rather directly to the classification in the lowest dimensional space for which a given type of killing vector can occur, the only cases that we need to consider in detail are those which led to black holes in the lower dimensional case, that is, the quotients that lead to black holes in ADS3. The blocks which appear in higher dimensions don't lead to any black hole-like quotients. And in fact, of the two things we could do to get black holes in ADS3, the more general case of rotating black holes will not lead to quotients in higher dimensions. The point is that a rotating black hole has a time-like singularity. And the only reason it's not interpreted as naked is that the boundary of the quotient is disconnected. So you can travel into the singularity and travel out to the boundary, but you find yourself in a different universe. Now, in the higher dimensional, when you take that quotient and you lift it up to higher dimensions, the boundary of the higher dimensional quotient contains part of the bulk, contains the bulk space-time that you had in lower dimensions. And so the boundary in higher dimensions is always automatically connected for these rotating cases, and hence the singularity is naked. So the only thing which leads to a black hole-like quotient in higher dimensions, is a boost plus any rotations you'd like to add. And a convenient way of writing the metric is just to use this general representation of the higher dimensional metric that we mentioned before. I have cos squared chi times the ADS3 black hole metric plus a sphere factor, and the killing vector is periodic identification in phi with possibly some twist on the sphere. And so that's basically all there is as far as black holes are concerned in higher dimensions. Okay, so in conclusion, we've seen that there's a very limited set of causally regular quotients that one can form by considering discrete identifications along the orbits of some killing vector in ADS. You can do the usual rotational identifications. You can do an identification along a null rotation, but this case is somewhat hard to understand because of the fixed points, both in the bulk and on the boundary. You can do an identification along an everywhere null killing vector. One can do this self-dual orbifold identification. In both of these cases, you get a causally regular bulk, but the boundary contains closed time-like curves. And you can do this double null rotation identification, where both the bulk and the boundary are completely free of closed time-like curves. And the quotient acts as a periodic identification of some coordinate, both in the bulk and in the boundary. It acts entirely as an isometry. These two space-like cases are stably causal, as is the null brain. And the whole story is somewhat disappointing from the point of view of trying to construct interesting examples of time-dependent space-times. All of these spaces have time-like killing vectors, with the exception of this one, but none of them have, at least have Euclidean sections, with, again, the exception of this guy, simply because I can't fit any of these killing vectors into SO1p plus 1. I can only fit them into SO2p. So these are, in some sense, intrinsically Lorentzian things, but they're not very time dependent. There's an interesting connection.
Does that mean, in particular, that none of them have a time reversal symmetry? I mean, they have a moment of time reversal symmetry?
Indeed. These are stationary but not static space time.
Okay, good.
There's an interesting connection with plane waves in several cases, and we saw that a coordinate system in which I write anti-de Sitter space or anti-de Sitter space across a sphere as conformal to a plane wave was quite useful. And that coordinate system may well be useful for other purposes as well. Generally speaking, the action on the boundary is worse than the action on the bulk. So you might have hoped to understand some pathological structure in the bulk by relating it to dual field theory, but when it comes to quotients, that rarely works. Anything that has closed time-like curves in the bulk is certainly going to have them in the boundary, and several things which didn't have them in the bulk had them in the boundary nonetheless. And finally, for the black holes, the story was somewhat less interesting. Instead of getting more things in higher dimensions, we got fewer, and the only thing you could consider was the analog of non-rotating BTC black holes. Okay, I'll stop here. Questions?
Just your final point, sir. Does your final point mean that it's not possible to take ADS in Poincaré coordinates and orbifold so as to render the Poincaré horizon spatially compact?
Orbifold so as to render the Poincaré horizon spatially compact. Well, naively, I can do that. First of all, to do that in higher dimensions, I would need to consider orbifolds with more than one generator, which is beyond the scope of what I've been trying to do here.
The reason I ask is that you can always, in general, if you can factorify, black strings to get black holes, but you can't factorify black brains to get black holes, for extremely black brains, because facing this issue, it boils down to having to make identification, compactify the Poincaré horizon, which you can do from ADS3 to ADS2, but I'm not aware of any way of doing it for high dimensional ADS.
Yeah, I think I would probably agree with that statement, but it's a little beyond the scope of what we've been trying to do here. Certainly you can't make the Poincaré horizon spatially compact with one identification, but that's not surprising because it's got more than one direction. Gary, you had a question?
Well, yeah, I was just wondering, again, back to this last point. So in ordinary PTZ, the rotating black holes are really non-singular, and you have these region closed time-like curves.
Right.
Which you said you have to remove, but I don't really see why.
Well, I'm just saying the definition we took of a space-time that I interpret as a black hole is that I remove, I'm focused on constructing causally regular quotients. So I can do two things. I can either be very dogmatic and insist on having a causally regular quotient in the whole ADS space. Or I could say, I'll be happy if I can take part of ADS space and get a causally regular quotient. Of course, then I have an incomplete space-time. My quotient will not be complete. And my question is just, can that incomplete space-time be interpreted as a black hole if I consider the surface where I've cut part of the space-time away as a singularity? It's not singular, of course, in the rotating case, but that's just the question we're asking. Well, I can. These are supersymmetric. This is supersymmetric taken on its own, but you'd get closed null curves. You could make it supersymmetric and everywhere space-like if you add a suitable rotation on, you have to add a suitable rotation and a suitable deformation on the sphere. If you just add one or the other, you break the supersymmetry. The story here is similar. It's supersymmetric on its own. It's just spatial translation in Poincaré coordinates, but it's not causally well-behaved. To make it causally well-behaved, I have to add a sphere deformation, but I have to add two kinds of sphere deformations to make sure that it remains supersymmetric after I add the deformation. And I think as a result, these tend to preserve less supersymmetry than these do, but I don't remember all the details.
Four questions.